Hello, welcome, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time it is where you are. Thanks once again for choosing Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, and I can also be found as the host of film podcast We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, and as the resident film correspondent of Express FM, as well as host of their movie music show, The Composer Series. Joining me is Sean Wilson. Remind the listener, Sean, of who you are and all the wonderful work you do, my friend.
Well, just to reiterate, I am Sean Wilson. There is a bit more dimension to that.
You are so, Sean Wilson and not Alexandre Desplat.
And not Alexandre Desplat, no. And I might resist doing my impression.
No, that was your cue. That was literally your cue.
That was my cue. Well, I am Sean Wilson. I am not Alexandre Desplat. No, I will stop.
Yes, I'm going to do it. Okay. Yeah, but who are you? We know who he is. He is an amazing composer.
He is one of my favorites. But I am the author of The Sound of Cinema, and I am a soundtrack journalist and podcaster and regular aficionado of film music. And yeah, and other things to match.
So I'm gonna need you to plug that book, mate. You know this. Come on. You know this is coming.
Yes. You're forcing me out of my comfort zone. So The Sound of Cinema is an examination of the 120 plus year history of film music, ranging from the early days of Nickelodeon through to the Talking Pictures era, then through the Golden Age, through counterculture Hollywood into the modern age, encompassing all manner of fantastic artists and interspersing interviews of my own that I undertook with various Hollywood film composers, including the likes of Michael Giacchino. So available now from Macfarlane Publishing.
There we go. Buy the book. Buy it. Is there like an NLP thing that we can do and go buy the book? Like every now and again, we'll just layer it into like even
buy the book. You've got to do it by the book.
By the book. This everything must be done by the book. No, but I mean, we'll like layer it into the podcast as we go into like the interview. Every now and again, we'll just subtly underneath Ludwig going, buy the book.
Well, I just like an echo.
Buy the book.
Like a whispering effect, yeah. I'll sign off on that.
Buy the book.
Might be a good marketing strategy.
Buy the book. Buy the book. We can turn up to screenings and stuff with buy the book on the t-shirt. Anywho, this week's show sees us back with a nuclear bang as we welcome very special guest Ludvig Göransson, the eminent and multi-award-winning composer of some of the finest scores around right now, including knockout work on Rocky Verse entries Creed and Creed 2, interstellar instrumentation on Star Wars series The Mandalorian, and globally adored music on Ryan Coogler's outstanding Black Panther films for Marvel. He first teamed up with the phenomenal filmmaker Christopher Nolan on the sci-fi time warping, time jumping. I still don't understand it. Time inverting.
Yeah.
Tenet. Yeah. Yes. Tenet was its name. And their so far successful working relationship continues with, as declared by many, Ludwig's best and finest work to date on his brand new score for Christopher Nolan's newest masterwork, Oppenheimer, which drops into cinemas this weekend. Tell us about the film, Sean.
Well, it's Christopher Nolan, so it's a lot of film, 3 hours worth, very, very dense, juggling timelines, characters, dialogue, ideologies, all scrambling around each other like the proverbial atom, which is appropriate enough for the themes of the movie. Sprawling, dense, complicated, utterly engrossing, but all anchored by a phenomenal performance by Cillian Murphy, who is the best he's ever been. It's a lot of responsibility to lay on the shoulders of one actor, and it is almost exhaustively and propulsively driven by Ludwig's score, which really doesn't stop through all the way through a three-hour movie. It's this alternately lyrical and keening, arresting, pulsating soundscape that, as we'll hear in the following interview, draws a lot on the dynamic range of the violin, but there's a lot of very, very interesting electronic effects in there as well, particularly as we develop towards the all-important Trinity test, which Nolan and his crew famously recreated for real in the Los Alamos desert, which is, that's an extraordinary sequence as one would expect. But Ludwig's score really gets to the sort of fractured heart of who Oppenheimer was as a person. It's a really terrific piece of work.
I am really, really, really excited for what we're about to play you next, because if you know anything about Oppenheimer or Ludwig, you'll know you're in for a treat with this one. Sean and I caught up with Ludwig for an hour to discuss in great detail the process of creating the sound of Oppenheimer, and we have that full uncut conversation here for you right now on this, your latest episode of Scoreheads.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb,
they have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope. All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
You're the great improviser, but this, you can't do in your head.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero.
Sean and I are incredibly excited now to welcome back to the show a composer whose incredible work continues to go from strength to phenomenal strength with every excellent project that he undertakes. A warm good afternoon now to Mr. Ludwig Göransson. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. And again, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Last we spoke about Tenet, and of course, it's been a few years since then. And one of the things we discussed was your working relationship with Christopher Nolan. And I thought a good place for us to start would be to ask, how has that relationship developed since Tenet? And what's it been like working with Christopher again on this huge new film, Oppenheimer?
Well, you know, ever since we finished Tenet, we always kept in touch, you know, and it's always, we hang out, we talk about movies, we talk about film. It's a collaboration that also, you know, I was kind of keeping in touch with things that are exciting or things that I feel like exciting or things that I want to show him or play him or movies that he wants to show me. So but even though like we keep in touch and we talk and, you know, he never tells me like, oh, I'm working on this little thing right now. It's about this. Like it's very kind of secretive in what's, you know, what's going on with his work until you get that phone call one day. It's like, hey, done with the script. You want to come by tomorrow and read this new script I've been working on? So when I got that call, I obviously went to go read Oppenheimer and but I had no idea what it was about. So it was quite a, you know, never read anything like that before, you know, where you get into that one person's perspective and feel everything through his eyes. That was quite an experience. And I understood pretty quickly that the music needs to feel just like that.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, because Christopher Nolan has said that unusually he wrote the script in first person, which creates a very subjective, the actors have said that creates a very subjective point of view when they're reading the script. I wondered for you yourself as a composer, did something about the script being written in that manner kind of inspire certain musical ideas or approaches?
Absolutely, but mostly it was just kind of like, okay, this is going to be a challenge because it's like a format that I haven't dabbled in, I haven't worked in before. And it's also like he's such a complex character. There's so much going on behind in that mind. And you know, obviously he's a genius, but it also has some skeletons hanging in his closet. You know, there's multi dimensions to his personality, and then there's a lot of music that you need to cover on that spectrum. So that was the big challenge for sure.
Those hearing about the film for the first time, I mean, it's hard not to do that, right? It's huge. But how would you describe what it was about in your own words? How would you describe it?
The movie?
The movie itself.
It's hard to put to put in a genre, because there's so many genres in there. You know, it's a thriller, it's horror, it's like this incredible intimate shots of Killian. But then you go from that intimate to like a huge set piece of the bomb, and so it's like you're going through this roller coaster of feelings and emotions and visuals. Also, the visuals are just astounding. You know, one of the first things that I saw before, after I read the script, was Chris invited me into a screening at an IMAX theater where he and Andrew Jackson, the visual effects guy, the supervisor, they had worked on the visuals, and as you already know, like none of it is CGI. So they've been doing different kind of experience. I'm sure they had a great time. It was like fun doing it because it looks amazing, and it's probably, you know, it kind of felt like they were just kind of discovering things as they were making it. And I was sitting there in the theater, it's a darkened theater, and I'm watching this big screen, and I'm seeing these like fluorescent lights just swirling around, you know, faster and faster and faster and faster, and like for 30 minutes, just different experience, just different experiments. And that whole visual for me was just incredible, mostly because like I felt like I'd never seen anything like it before. Usually when you see something like that in CGI, you can put a time step on it, like that was created like last year, or you know, that was 2015, but here it's like it's timeless. You know, you don't know if is it from the past, or is it from the future, or is it, you know, it feels generally timeless. And when I saw those swirling, spinning atoms like that, that's when I got the idea of like, that's how I want the music to sound like.
You're dealing with a central character who is taking theories from inside his mind. He's kind of living inside his head, and he's making those theories like practical and actual. And I wondered, is it the role of the music in the film to kind of draw out that inner dialogue of what's going on with Oppenheimer's thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. As an audience, you never want to judge this person. You always want to be with him. You want to experience the world he's seeing and the emotions that he's going through. So, and like I said, like earlier, it's very complex. Like you have sometimes in the movie, you have these flashbacks or like these dreams that he has when he's just, you know, in his bed and he closes his eyes and it goes inside of his head. So how do you make the music go in between that dream state and the reality? And like it, because it's, you know, he's extremely engaged in the world, but also like what's going on in his head is probably 100 times faster and more complicated than a normal person. You know,
how long does it take to produce a score like this? Because obviously we talked before about Tenet, because it is a score, but at the same time there are a lot of soundscapes with Tenet as well that you brought to that canvas. How long does something like, bearing in mind the movie is long in and of itself, it's 3 hours long, of course, but how long did it take you to kind of realize that artistically and bring it all together?
I would think about 6 to 9 months. You know, we get started very early in the process, even before you start shooting the film in pre-production. That's when we sit down. That's when we have our conversations. That's we meet up once a week. We talk about like the one of the first early indicators and thoughts that Chris had was just, he was like, oh, what if he heard the violin and he was thinking about the violin portraying Oppenheimer, especially because of how the violin is a fretless instrument, you know, and depending on the speed and how hard you press down the bow, you know, you can go from something very romantic and gentle to something neurotic and horrific and manic in a split second. And fortunately for me, my wife Serena and artistic partner, she's a violinist, so I was able to work with her on all those experiments. And we spent a couple of months having the time to explore and see where we could take that sound image. And every week I was meeting up with Chris, playing him what I've done and talking about it, analyzing it. You know, and we listened to one piece of music 5-6 times, and then we dissect it. And we go through it. We talk about specific things that we like. And then we go on like that for 3 months, and that's how we create the DNA of the sound world that Oppenheimer's in, and then he starts shooting, and he has about 2-3 hours of music to listen to while he's doing it.
Yeah, that's really interesting hearing about the violin, because one often hears that the range, the dynamic range of the violin is often compared to like the register of the human voice. I've heard this, and about how the violin is very good for depicting character drama. And like you said, I suppose it's an effective instrument, isn't it? Because on the one level, this is a very plaintive, melancholic story, yet also in its own way, it is a triumphal story. It's a man who creates something, but his creation gets away from him. So I imagine the violin suits that complexity very well.
Yeah, and also, but also like through time, you know, you've been using violins as there's certain techniques where you have like a cluster in horror movies, for example, you have a, like a violin cluster, like think like Hitchcock or like Psycho, like, and you have like these like uneasy violins and string effects. But how can you take those kind of elements, but if you play it in a completely different way with different performance, like almost like the same kind of clusters, but with a romantic, beautiful tone, you know, how is that going to sound? And, you know, we use a lot of those elements for Oppenheimer's journey, and especially also for his relationship with Gene Tatlock and kind of that kind of unsettling, not knowing where you are. Like, am I supposed to feel, you know, horror here, or am I supposed to feel like the more emotional, romantic part of it? So, and I feel like that was like the state that he's in. You know, he's already from the beginning, like he knows what he's doing, right? He's but he doesn't. I think, you know, he didn't. There's no way he knows. I mean, I don't know, like the impact that it's gonna have. You know, I mean, he's changing the world.
Like the consequences of it are not known, is it really? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
break down for us, if you will. You talked about this. You can't really put this film into one genre, which is because it has so many elements to it creatively. So let's talk about how the kind of soundscapes, the sound world, the sound palette that you're using, from instruments to tech. You know, how did you bring this? What's in the sound of the film, and how did you bring it all together?
Well, I think my approach from the beginning, I wanted to focus on getting the emotional core of his character into the music first. So almost all the demos and all the ideas I did in the beginning, the first couple of months, was just strictly strings and organic instruments, orchestra, piano. And because I knew that, like, if we get that right, the electronics and the synthesizer and the modern production, that will take care of itself. I mean, it's still a challenge to put that in, but like I know those elements, it's going to come natural. Like, we just need to focus on the emotional core first. So that's where I started creating that emotional core. And then as we moved further, like with that, I sprinkled in, I topped the music in with that. I would feel like, it feels like the synthesizers and the modern production is kind of channeling the impending doom. And like I said a little bit earlier, like, even though, like, yeah, he has that feeling inside of himself, like he's of impending doom.
I suppose that's a really good way of, if a character is living with something, if a character is living with a sense of doom, and then the music can externalize that and it can make it evident for the audience, right? And that's a really interesting way of how one can lead with music in a film like this.
Yeah, and then, I mean, even in one of the opening shots, he's trying to poisonous professor, you know. So it's like, he's a complex character, and I think for half the movie, you know, we're in this kind of orchestral string heavy world, but that's also the part of the movie where most of it is just kind of theoretical. Like, they're talking about the bomb, but it's mostly the scribbles. They're working on the whiteboard, and they're talking about it, but then there's this massive shift in the movie where the bomb is actually becoming a physical reality. And you see them handling it. You see them poising up in the air, and they know that, well, if something goes wrong, there's even a chance that we can blow up the whole world, you know? And that's when the music also takes a shift. We go into a different part of his mind and a different, which is that it shifts into just kind of electronics, and the sounds are more like actually sound design. And I'm focusing on there's three elements. There's one bass, a steady bass that kind of symbolizes the bomb. There's one kind of almost sound like a nuclear reaction kind of weird sound, and then there's like one tinkering like metallic sound on top of that, and they're all doing like a different rhythmical elements, but it's just that it's building that tension in there and the thing of like, holy, like this is actually, you know, we're about to do this now.
Speaking of, how did you feel like when you first sat down and like you say, you watched that cut of the movie, were you feeling incredibly excited about how you were going to approach it, or were you feeling incredibly, like you say, kind of nervous about this is huge, like how am I gonna, you know, what, how can I bring my best game to this? How were you feeling?
It was, I mean, with Chris, it's like anything when we work together, it's like it's just, it's most of the time it's just there's an excitement there from the get-go to the end that we're working on something important. And especially with this movie, you know, having even though it's a period piece, but I feel like it couldn't come out at any better time than now. And with the feeling I had when I saw the first cut, it's like I'm almost sitting by the edge of the seat throughout the whole movie. And that's for a 3-hour movie, that's a pretty good feat.
Yeah, because when you described there, when you see the theory becoming real and the bomb they're actually handling, I actually got the hairs on the back of my neck actually started to stand up just at that moment, just as you were describing it. It's interesting because I suppose roughly contemporaneous with the events in the film, in the world of film music, you had, I mean, a few years after the events of Oppenheimer, contemporaneous with it, you had Bernard Herrmann experimenting with electronics in like The Day the Earth Stood Still and everything. Is that a kind of, was it a kind of like analog synthetic sound that you were looking for? Or do you say, was it like a modern synthetic sound that's grafted onto a period setting?
Yeah, I never thought, you know, I talked to, you know, like one of the first questions, like, well, do you want this to sound like a period piece? And then Chris was pretty adamant in the beginning that like, whatever you want to do, and like free hands, like, I don't want to tie anyone up to those feelings and to that time period. And I think you can see that in every part of the movie, costume design, you know, like the costumes feel the time, but also they feel that it could be something that people wear today or even 10 years, you know, it's like you can't. And I would just describe it as timeless, right? And that's the same thing I was thinking about the music. I like how some of the instruments are from the time, but also I want it to be made in a way it could not have been done before, and in a way it could only have been done today. And I want it to feel timeless. And it was important for me to have that freedom.
Did you get to sort of work or meet with any of the cast during the process, and how did they feel? I get that kind of doesn't happen really till premieres and things when everybody gets to see everything fully finished, but I was just interested to see their kind of responses to your score and how they feel about it.
Yeah, I went to set for maybe 2 days and I got to meet Killian when he was, you know, he was shooting a scene with Pash, and you know, just coming in there and also like just see how Chris builds up his set with the Jong, and just I always like on all the projects that I do to kind of come into their world and see how that process is being handled, and also getting to talk to Killian for a couple of minutes and just see where his headspace is at and how he's, you know, it doesn't have to be a lot, but everything that I can get is always going to affect how I'm feeling and how I'm thinking, and it always leaves an impression on me. And especially with working with Chris, and it's like he brings everyone into, you know, he brings me in on the visual effects meeting or in like an early production meeting, so we all feel like we're part of the creative family.
This might just be me thinking this, but because this is the film is about a man who creates a spark. There's a spark of an idea in it, and it ignites a whole field of creativity. I wondered, did you identify with that as a composer and an artist on your own level, in terms of like you have an idea and then it atomizes and then it kind of expands in something bigger than you imagine?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a cool way to put it. I feel like, you know, one of the first things I did was to record his theme. And it came, you know, it came out with just a violin solo, and which I played, which my wife Serena played, and it's just like a very intimate melody, and I sent it to Chris, and he immediately was like, yeah, this is this is Oppenheimer's theme, and there's a place in the movie where, I mean, that theme plays throughout the movie but in different iterations, but there's kind of what you were saying where it's like he's unlocking all these things in his mind, and there's a scene in the movie which is one of the first montages, early montage in the movie, where Kenneth Branagh is like asked, telling like can you hear the music, and he's like a student at the university, and he is at the time of his life when his mind really starts exploding, right? And the way that the pictures in the movie is incredible, and the way that that musical piece came about was for me to do something that I've never done before with sounds and with tempos. And there's about 21 tempo changes in that piece of music. It starts off three times faster. It ends three times faster than when it starts. And it's all played with a string orchestra and we recorded it all in one take. And it's already fast movement from the beginning. And we spent 3 days working on just that piece of music. And that was a real challenge to get together. First, I thought we were going to have to just divide it and do it in sections. But then we kind of came up with a new way to feed the musicians a metronome click in their head when the new tempo happened before it happened on the page. So they were able to record that whole piece of music in one unbroken recording. And that really, to me, this just how that came alive and how that depicted the last scene of that montage when everything is just kind of coming together in that visual fluorescent light was just kind of magical to me.
How, again, we were going back to like working with Chris, and you were saying about watching him on set and the kind of majesty of that, I guess. But we talked a few times about what he's like to work with, but he just seems like there's a very kind of family atmosphere working with Chris. That's the impression I get from anyone I talk to that works for him. Like, this is a guy that has got command of his set, of his art, but at the same time, like you say, everyone feels inclusive, like you are one big family. Would you say that was true?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, he, you know, there's not a single job that like he's involved on all dimensions. And I know how involved he is with the music, and I can just imagine that he's like that with all the departments. I can see that he cares so much about that, about every little detail. And like, I mean, when I went to set, there were one of the days they were shooting the scene with when Ravi and Oppenheimer are in a little train car together and they're having their first meeting. And I see Chris on the side, like he's the one shaking the train, so physically with his hands. He wanted to get that exact right moment and exact feel of a train moving. So he did it himself with his hands.
he's that guy that, you know, we always talk about a good boss is someone that will roll up their sleeves and do the jobs that they ask everybody else to do, right? He's very in the trenches.
Exactly. That obviously has an effect on everything.
Yeah. And talking about how Christopher Nolan's process, I wondered about the spotting process with the movie when you sit down with him and you identify the key points, the start and the end points. Is there a sense in this particular film that you mentioned there were lots of tempo changes during the opening, during that initial sequence, there were lots of acknowledgements. Is that characteristic of the whole film in that there's lots of musical acknowledgements for moments within the scene, or is it kind of music that kind of was designed to kind of wash over in like suite like arrangements?
Yeah, I would say in the beginning, you know, I write about 3 hours of music, and then he shoots the film, and then when he starts editing the movie with Jennifer Lame, our editor, you know, they put in the music that I've written for the scenes. And so then in the beginning, it's kind of like a sweet feel to the feel of the movie. But since it's our own movie, like everything feels fresh and new. But then after he does that, after we have our first cut, that's when the real work starts for me, because that's when you have to like really massage the music to feel like it's also, you know, sometimes you want that kind of wash over a scene, but sometimes you also really need to follow the action and what's happening. A lot of the times it's the way we can work on a scene together is it's really a different way for me to work, because like Chris might be, he for 1 or 2 weeks, for example, he and Jennifer Lane was working on the trial in the end, you know, and then it was like, in the beginning, it was like a 25 minute scene. And Chris like asked me to write a 25 minute piece of music that was just had energy and had a pace. And then I just kind of wrote something just without picture and a 25 minute of music that I sent back to him. They massage it into the scene. They send it back to me, and I wrote another 25 minute of music, and then I send it back. So it's like a back and forth, and then finally I get the picture, and I see the scene, and I see what I did, and I kind of redo everything one more time. So it's like a lot of it's a very collaborative process, I would say.
I guess for the album though, that would that translate into a 25 minute track, or does that get broken down? How does that work? And also, actually, while we're on that subject, with a movie of this size, how do you decide what makes the album cut for the soundtrack, right?
Yeah, so for that, like every other day I worked on that piece of music for that scene. And the first day was 25 minutes. The second day, the cut was 23 minutes. And in the end, I think that scene is about 12 to 15 minutes. That's what they got it down to. And for the soundtrack, you know, we have that 15 minute piece of the final composition into the soundtrack. And also what's cool is like, is Chris is also very involved in the soundtrack, and we want to make it right for the movie. And we want to, you know, sometimes a lot of times you kind of hone down on your favorites and you make it, you know, you make it 90 minutes long or 100 minutes long. But for this one, since it's the material's so dense and there's so many characters and the performance and the ensemble is so incredible. So like it, almost every character and all have their own tones, they have their own feelings, and there's so the material is so dense. So I think the score album is, I mean, I don't know. It's pretty long. We couldn't really kill our darlings there.
I'm looking forward to seeing that finished. Definitely. When it comes.
Yeah. Likewise, yeah. It's so you mentioned there that there are, I mean, the movie's got an incredible ensemble cast, and like you said, there are so many characters and it is so dense. So I imagine wasn't feasible to write obviously themes for everybody. I imagine Oppenheimer has his theme, like we've discussed. Are there themes for like other primary characters in drama?
I would say every time, you know, the movie shifts to Strauss' perspective, the music changes slightly there. There's like the Rhodes and the harp that comes in with Strauss' narrative and his point of view. And then Oppenheimer and Kitty, they have that bond. They have that marriage, that she's the person that kind of, you know, calls him out on his bullshit. You know, she's the one that can tell him that it's I guess it's called marriage, right? But, you know... But they have this really beautiful, sweet, there is that strong bond between them, and they have that, there's a track called, I think it's like Meeting Kitty, and you also hear that track, you also hear that theme when she's testifying in the end, and it's this kind of very powerful, emotional piano ballad that kind of ties them together, and it's yeah.
You were talking about your wife playing on some of that. Was she working on the romantic theme as well with you?
She was very much part of the all the violin and the string experiments, and also, you know, part of you know, we did a lot of recording. Like we recorded for about 10 days, and she's been in the Hollywood orchestra for, you know, 20 years playing in that setting. So when it came to, for example, when it came to that whole thing with the tempo changes, she was like, you know, she kind of helped crack the code with, like, you know, these musicians, I didn't think it was possible to have them, to give the musicians a new like 21 different metronomic clicks before the tempo changes. But she was like, these guys are just so good, they can do this in one take. And so it was extremely helpful to have her on the process.
I just love the beautiful poetry as well of a husband and wife working on a husband and wife's theme.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
She's playing the solo there when Kitty's testifying. You know, it's beautiful.
And similarly, does she call you out on your bullshit?
Absolutely.
The reflective. You need that. Marriage, right? Marriage.
You need that, yeah.
Sean. Or I was going to, I'm always compelled when you get a dialogue-driven movie like such as this, and when the characters are, they're verbalizing things that are so theoretically complicated, and these theories are poised to change the world, and is it a challenge knowing within the sound mix, like when to play forward with the music and when to play back, when to hold back with the music in terms of like, right, the audience actually needs to be able to sort of hear what the characters are saying to each other. I wondered how that process worked.
Well, that's why Chris is such a great storyteller, because we kind of ended up scoring a lot of those scenes almost like an action film. You know, when you go into that final trial, like the music is very propelling. It's almost like it could be that could be for an action scene, and you have that, you know, it's kind of aggressive at times, and it's like propelling the story, and it's pushing the dialogue, and you know, maybe you know, from my point of view in the beginning, I would probably be like oh, a little scared of like taking too much space, you know, like let's be quiet here, let's, like, this is a dialogue scene, but he had a crystal clear point of view when what the film was about and what he was trying to do, and that's always very extremely helpful. But also, even though he has a crystal clear point of view, like, he's also very open to my input and to my thoughts, and you know, we're always trying new things and constantly pushing and pulling and pushing and pushing the music into new interesting directions.
We always talk about how with each project, artistically, one grows, right? And so you learn things, you teach yourself things, and the work teaches you things. What did you learn about yourself on this project as well? And what did it teach you? How did you grow from working on this project?
Yeah, I for every project that I do, I like to kind of tackle it in a completely new way. You know, I want to feel like I'm discovering something new. I want to feel like I'm working my way towards something in a way that I've never done before. And for this one, like I mentioned earlier, it's like I started out with just kind of finding the emotional core and just kind of writing it with just organic elements, and then putting the synthesizers after. But to go to your question about like what I learned about myself was, I'm still very much in the process and in the aftermath of having worked on this movie, because it was such a big part of my life for a long time. And I like to work on projects where I get to really go all in on it and kind of eat, live, and breathe the movie. And so I can't fully say yet how, in what way I've been growing, but I feel like, you know, I definitely changed and become a different person and grown in both creative ways and both personal ways too. So, but I'm still yet to find out how to put words on it.
Is it safe to say that for composers and indeed other artists as well, that movies like this, that movies of this magnitude don't really come around all that often? Is it kind of a question of like, oh wow, this is like genuinely, you know, this is genuinely allowing me to fire on all cylinders creatively?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like I'm fortunate enough to feel like I'm able to work on projects, because it's kind of like you said, that makes yourself grow, right? And as long as you're working on movies and or projects that feel like they really mean something to you, I think you're on the right track. And both Tenet and Oppenheimer really took, like, I learned a lot from those experiences, and that's always what I want to feel like when I'm working on a big movie, that I'm, you know, because you put so much of yourself into it, you give it so much, you give it everything you got, and that's only because you feel like you're getting something in return, right? You feel like you're getting something back from it, and that feeling is, you know, that's what I want to continue doing for my career.
And also, I think, because obviously Wakanda Forever, for example, and you must have worked on those projects consecutively, right? This and how did that work out? Did you work on Black Panther first and then directly onto Oppenheimer, or did you kind of, was there kind of any crossover there? Because you said you worked on Oppenheimer for a long time. How did that work out, and how do you keep up with the pace of that, of course, as well?
Yeah, that was like a really intense, I don't know if it was last year. I think it was last year. It was a really intense part of my life, because I was obviously like Wakanda Forever is also a huge monumental movie and an important movie, and where I was also giving everything that I got on that. And to basically, it was like, I was finishing that. And then the next day, like, straight into this. And so it was, that was an intense feeling, an intense way of going into something. But that's just how it turned out. And it's hard to kind of, because it was so intense, it's hard to kind of even remember last year, because I was in a different space, and you know, my whole life was devoted to the arts, and so it's nice now to get a little bit of headspace and thinking about what you were actually doing. You know,
I kind of feel like you're long overdue a vacation.
Well, I mean, as soon as we wrap this movie, me and Serena and the kids, we've been traveling around, so. That was in March, so it's nice. It's really nice now to have some time off and come back to it now and kind of like thinking about what we actually did, and it's a really nice feeling, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because so much of the film itself is about part of the aftermath in the film is about reflection, isn't it? It's about thinking about one's technical achievements, and I suppose in a way, the emotionality of this film must speak to people, right? It's kind of like, it's the act of creation, you know, it's also about what happens afterwards and everything, which I suppose makes it an interesting experience, right?
Yeah, and like, we had the premiere in London was yesterday, and so I had my family, my parents and my sister came out, and we saw the movie for the first time with them, and I think and it just kind of struck me, this like, and especially like I'm Swedish, and so, and they came from Sweden over here, and then I think especially with what's happened the last 6-9 months, you know, it's been kind of a change in the world, and I think the imminent threat of what's going on, and especially how close Sweden is to it, and Swedes maybe don't talk about that kind of things, like open up and talk about kind of some of the darker subjects or some of those threats. But I think this movie can help with that. We should go, you know, see it with your friends, and then having these kind of, I think they can open up for some really interesting discussions with your close ones.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a cathartic experience almost, in a way, watching this movie, and it sounds like it's designed as a cathartic experience.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it is, you really go through the whole emotional spectrum of him, and also hopefully it resonates that it's like you're feeling it yourself too. And I think that's what's really important and unique about this film.
It covers, you know, as you say, true events and an incredibly serious and sensitive subject matter as well. Like you're saying, it's quite reflective actually of what's going on right now. But I imagine artistically that requires some pretty heavy lifting, both musically and emotionally, for you as well as a composer. How do you work through something artistically like that, that you know is going to be pretty emotionally heavy and dark in tone? And actually, what do you do to relax after something of such size and scale and weight? As a project like this must have been, there must have been times, like you say, you take things away from it when you were on set, when you were watching cuts of the film and whatever, but how do you process that emotionally as an artist? Because there's quite a lot going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I said about last year is you're so deep inside of it, and you go so deep inside of yourself and those emotions. And I think it is really heavy. But at the time, you don't have the time, or you don't have to really to really process those feelings and think about what you're doing, even though you're constantly drawing from that depth. And it's not until like, and it took me even some time after I was on took a break on vacation before I'm like actually capable of kind of reach back to that moment and reach back to that when I was really in the state of mind and process those difficult feelings and emotions and understand where everything came from. And it's a very interesting part of the work, but I think it is, I think that's what it felt so important to kind of have that time just for myself and for my family to just to be able to kind of process that and take my time to just understand myself a little bit better.
Well, just to wind the clock back, which I suppose is actually appropriate for a Christopher Nolan film, given we're playing around with timelines and things like that. Yeah. That first moment where you got the call to work with him on Tenet, this was your first collaboration with him, and this is the moment where that partnership was cemented and was formed for the first time. Like, what was your initial like visceral reaction to like, oh man, I'm going to be working with Christopher Nolan for the first time?
At first it was just like an extreme surprise. You know, I was like, it was some kind of dream, but you never thought that would come into reality, that I never even think that would be an option on the table. So it was that surprise of like, you know, this is something unimaginable is going to happen. And then as soon as we meet, that whole feeling of something unimaginable, like it just, you know, it just instantly becomes reality. And then like, okay. And then it's just, yeah, it becomes your reality, and you just it's one of the most, you know, exciting adventures.
Is it a little surreal though? Like sometimes I guess if he comes and sits in the studio or you're on the set and you kind of look across him, you're like, I work for Christopher Nolan. Is that, you know, is it like pinch me moments? Does that happen?
I think the pinch me moments kind of happened before we started working. But then when it becomes a reality, you're in the situation, you don't it's part of your, life. You know, you're on the journey. So it's reality. So
you worked on so many projects, like both in film and in terms of a record production with collaborations with other artists outside the world of film. And I wondered how much is an artist and a composer like yourself, how much are you like the sum total of your artistic experiences? Like, do you cumulatively inherently bring all of those past artistic projects to bear on every new film that you do?
I think so. Yeah, I think every experience I had, and most of them in my career, has been, I think, for me, building relationships with incredible directors or incredible artists, has, and building on those relationships over and over and over again, and that's the realization where you know you're getting something back in your life, and every process is different, but you're only adding on to your toolbox. You know, like I'm from all my experiences, I'm bringing that back to me, and I'm there, it's giving something back to me, and I'm getting just a bigger arsenal of tools to choose from how to approach my projects. But like I said earlier, like I like, even though I have all those tools, like I like to approach every project in a completely new way, so it feels like I'm discovering something new for the first time.
That's an entirely fair statement. I always say about your work that you're always smashing your own bar. I mean, that's evident to us as a listener, man. Like every score I listen to a score of yours, I'm like, that's amazing. And then your next one, I'm like, oh my God, that's even more amazing. Like Wakanda Forever was so big. It felt much, although your Black Panther score is phenomenal, like game changing. And yet Wakanda Forever just felt so much bigger, more resonant, more emotional as well. As I say, is that you're always striving, right, to continue to push yourself and push your own bar, I guess.
That's the goal. And they, like, I have that in common with the people that I'm working with. You're always searching for something that's different than what you did last year. You know, like, I don't want to do the same thing over and over again. And I want to grow, but I want to get bigger. I want to it's so close with your personal growth too. Like it's music, and it's a product for it, you know, for, and it's a commercial product in the end, but it's also you're putting so much effort into it. So if it's not personal, then what's the point?
Yeah, it all goes back to collaboration, isn't it? Like we were discussing earlier, like if you find a collaborator, whether you're working on a film or whether you're working with Childish Gambino or someone like that, if you make that connection, then surely you're going to get special results out of it.
Yeah, and what's cool about it is like, yeah, with both Childish Gambino and with Ryan Coogler, like I started writing music with Donald Glover in his little loft apartment downtown LA. And I mean, we were working on a song on Cul-de-Sac on his first mixtape, and it was an earthquake. And and we just run down from the building from the top floor, like 20 stairs down and kind of freak out. But, and then with Ryan Coogler, like I was sitting in my dorm at USC. You know, it was called a fraternity. I wasn't a part of the fraternity, but the fraternity had gone thrown up because they had too many like drug parties. So it was only open for grad students, but it was on the, I didn't even know what a fraternity was, but it was on that street where it literally felt like I was part of an American Pie movie. But Ryan would come there and we'd sit in that tiny little room with headphones, and I would play him what I did. And he was like, who would freak out about the music? And part of it is like, it hasn't changed, you know, it's still that same kind of excitement. It's just, I guess for a bigger audience, you know. But
actually, Sean, I know we were talking to John Murphy about this, and I think actually it might be poignant here. But looking back now to the Ludwig in the dorm room all those years back, what advice would you give him now, sitting where you are now, knowing what you know?
I mean, I would just say that I wouldn't change anything. You know, everything's been just such a amazing journey, and I'm always looking back at the times with a lot of love but I was just and I wasn't that worried either, and that's the thing. Like I wasn't stressed, I wasn't worried. Like every I was discovering so many new things all every day, but I did, I remember I was missing home a lot. That was like a big thing, you know, moving across the world to do something, place you've never been before, and meeting, that was tough, but yeah, I would just probably say, just like, really enjoy the moments, enjoy your moments that you have, because I was very focused. I just did so much, you know. Maybe there was some part, some stuff that I didn't have to do, like some stuff that I, you know, didn't have to do that I did anyways, but like I just enjoy the process and enjoy the things that you really like. And I think that's what I'm doing now, you know.
Yeah, just to refer again to that interview, John, there was something that John Murphy said, which is that there's a kind of purity and there's a clarity of expression when someone is younger, when, you know, before someone has embarked on, you know, a hugely professional career, that when you're younger, you're just accumulating ideas and you're putting stuff out there. And would you say, would that resonate with you, do you think?
Yeah. And I think I think that's what you always aim for now too. You know, you're always aiming for that playfulness, right? You're always aiming for that feeling of creating, doing something for the first time or experiencing something for the first time. I think that's what we all crave for, on not just on creating, but like in all parts of life, you know, that kind of feeling, that sensation of, you remember when you tried sushi for the first time, you know, it's like, you know, that emotion and that feeling. And when you make something new for the first time, that's what's so exciting about what we're doing now. And that's always what I'm aiming for.
I think because I know we're coming to a close shortly, but I did want to ask you about, just in summary, I know we've kind of touched on this across the course of the last hour, but in summary, what do you feel has been the most challenging aspect of working on Oppenheimer? But also in answering that, what did you feel was the most rewarding?
Yeah, I think it is that time when you are really in some kind of black hole. I know you put a lot of pressure on yourself that like what I'm doing now needs to be the best thing I've ever done. And you're so not overwhelmed, but you, like, there's a lot of pressure from yourself to kind of outdo yourself. And so sometimes when you're in when in those moments you can't really hear what you're doing at the time, and so it's not like until like I finish that and then come back to it later in the day and then like, okay, yeah, listening to it with new fresh ears and then experiencing that in the theater, that is always a reward. And and then sitting there yesterday at the BFI with that sound system and with that screen was an incredible magical feeling, and the reward of that and being there with your family and think about everything that went into it. It's an incredible rewarding feeling, and I'm so extremely proud of what we did.
Are there any genres, particularly genres or styles of movie that you would like to tackle, bearing in mind you've worked across a huge sort of plethora of different kinds of movies already? Is there a particular kind of movie that you've got a desire to write music for?
I think there's a lot of things that I want to do, but I'm not putting the thought into it about searching things out, because I want it all to kind of happen naturally. And I feel like the last 5 years, just like everything's kind of happened in a very natural pace. Like everything that I've been doing feels like it's something completely different from what I did before, and it's working now, so I'm not going to change anything.
Well, of course, there's an Oscar being thrown in there as well, the first Oscar for a comic book score, which I was so thrilled about when that happened. I was like, yes, I was like, you broke through in the genre, that's fantastic. I was so happy when that happened.
hopefully an Oscar for Oppenheimer, that would be lovely. Fingers crossed. Ludwig, it's been so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming back onto the show. We really, really appreciate your time. Have a great day, and thank you so much again. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this talk, and I had a great time, and hopefully we get to do it again soon. Thank you.
Ludvig Göransson there discussing in great detail his score for the film Oppenheimer. What a film, what a score, what an artist, and what a guy.
Just, isn't it brilliant to be able to do an hour-long deep dive with an artist like that? It's not an opportunity that one gets very often for an hour.
For an hour, with an artist of his calibre.
Yeah.
It's a real thrill and a privilege, and we're very honoured to have been able to do that. I really, really enjoyed that. The film is just something else.
And further in, just so much further emboldened by that music, which is both, you know, the outer voice and the inner voice of Oppenheimer. And I think people heard in that interview exactly how Ludwig got into that process with the collaboration of Christopher Nolan and obviously Ludwig's team as well. Always lovely when a musical artist as skilled as he is can wear their creativity and their brilliance so lightly and so humbly. Yeah, he's a really, really interesting mercurial musical artist, and I'm really, really excited to see what movie project he's going to embark on next.
Well, I'm excited to have him back. It's your second time with him, wasn't it?
Yeah, second time. Yeah, it was when Black Panther was the first time I spoke to him for which, he, as we said in the interview, where he won the Oscar. Yeah.
Yeah, I got Tenet, I think, was the first time. Yeah, very, very interesting, very lovely, lovely man, and very thrilled, as I say, and privileged to have him here on the show. You can, of course, see the film right now. It is in cinemas and theatres worldwide as you are listening to this. Do go and check it out. It's 3 hours long, but I promise you it's worth every single frame. I do want to thank View Cinemas, and largely because they made sure that I saw this just in time for us to release this podcast, which was very, very kind of them. Thank you very much to them. There is a view near you, myview.com, to see if there is a view near you. By all means, go and join them. They are enjoying the Barbenheimer weekend, which I'm sure is great. Do you know what? Isn't that great for cinemas? So
one of them, one of these movies foreshadows a post-apocalyptic future, and the other one is Oppenheimer.
So I love it, Yes, by all means, go check out both those films. They're two very different films, but by all means, Oppenheimer leading the way there, I think, is a 5-star. Instant classic, by all means. It's his JFK, isn't it? I think that's widely regarded.
I was just going to say, anyone lucky enough to be in the vicinity of an IMAX, because I was very privileged in my capacity as a journalist, I got to see it on 70mm IMAX, so like the best possible resolution, the best possible sound. I know opportunities for 70mm IMAX are very, very limited in the UK, but if you've got a digital IMAX exhibition anywhere near you, I would say I would advocate going to see it in that format, because that's how Nolan shot the movie, shot it on IMAX cameras, and that's really what does justice to the scale of Oppenheimer's story and the scale and the terror of his achievements. And obviously Ludwig's score sounds absolutely astonishing when it's projected in IMAX sound as well. So
for sure, absolutely phenomenal. Everything he does, it just turns to gold, doesn't it? And of course, so if you want to check that out right now, it is in cinemas and theatres. The music, Ludwig's amazing score, is available, as far as I'm aware, on Backlot Music, who we also want to thank for Nikki and all the team there. Nikki, Elizabeth, and all the team at Backlot Music, thank you so much for your support, and all the supporting publicity teams that worked to get this across the line and to make sure that we did this. Thank you very much to you. To get the album now, I say album, it's a masterwork, a collection. It's more of an album. I think it's longer than an album, but it's a listening experience as much as it is in the movie, for sure. Check that out right now via Backlot Music. I think I've said thank you to everyone. Thank you to you, Sean.
And thank you to you.
It's been a real thrill. We will be back next week. I'm just going to leave that there, because we've definitely got something exciting. But then we might do other stuff in between, so I don't know.
I'm just going to describe that as a cliffhanger. Is that an implicit spoiler?
A cliffhanger, yeah. We could leave this as a cliffhanger, because we would definitely want to... let's just leave it there. I don't want to say anything else. It's very, very exciting. Put it this way. You need to make sure that you're here on the Need a Bigger Pod channel. So wherever, audioboom.com, if you're listening on Spotify, if you're listening on Apple, Google, Podchaser, you're seeing this on YouTube, wherever, right? Just keep it locked here, Need a Bigger Pod. At Need a Bigger Pod on all socials. Follow us there as well. Sean, where can we follow you? Not literally, of course. Don't give me your home address.
Yeah, perish of thought. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO22 and on Instagram at Sean Filmwriter.
There we go. I'm at John Brown TV. That's at JON Brown TV on all platforms, including that new one. But we're not promoting any of them. We're just going to go at JON Brown TV, at John Brown TV on all platforms. Thank you very much. And until next time, keep collecting them soundtracks.